This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The March to spring training and opening day is upon us. Rob Bradford from Baseball Isn't Boring here, and we'll have you covered every single day with podcasts that aim to educate, entertain, and inform you as a baseball fan. Follow Baseball Isn't Boring in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back here on WEEI. Shout out to our guy Justin Turpin for that question to Jason Tatum. Speaking of pimps, shout out Justin Turpin. I'm just kidding. But that was Jason Tatum being asked about the importance of playing well going into the All-Star break. And the Celtics right now, 39-16. They're second in the East, third overall in the NBA. Just a reference, last year, 43-12 at the All-Star break. So they're four games off their pace. And if you remember, the last team to repeat, the 2017-18 Warriors, they were eight games off their pace in a full season. So the Celtics are kind of in line with where that Warriors team was repeating. Again, just for reference. But I'm really happy with how they played going into the All-Star break, because they had that stretch where they were a 500 team for about 5-6 weeks. You go to, mid-December all the way through the, towards the end of January. They had that December 23rd loss to Orlando where they're up by 15 at halftime. Then they had that loss right after on Christmas. They had the loss in Toronto. Even the close loss to Houston, you're kind of like, the Houston was, Caleb Martin had 7 threes or whatever it was. So they had a few losses in there that, last year's team maybe was not going to lose to. And it brought up some concerns from some folks, but look, the Celtics have a plus nine in their point differential this year. They're 8-2 in their last 10 games. Their offensive rating is fourth. Defensive rating is fifth. Net rating is third. Look, last year they were top three in all three of those rating categories. So they're a little bit off what they were last year, but this is still an elite team. I still think, to me, they're the favorites to win the championship. And I think when you saw them going into the All-Star break, Dallas, and not the Dallas game they lost, but they're in Dallas. They win that game, blow out Dallas. That was a 3-1 road trip. Then they come home. I know they had the loss to Houston. They had the loss to Dallas at home as well. But then going into the All-Star break, their final three games, they beat the Knicks by 27. Tatum scored 40. They beat Miami, who wasn't that. I mean, Miami's depleted, obviously, by 18. Tatum at 33. And then they beat the Spurs pretty convincingly by 13, 116, 103. So I like the way they went into the All-Star break. And the way they went into the All-Star break, very similar to the way that they started the season, playing really well, blowing some teams out. So I think what we saw was a little bit of a malaise from that mid-December through January time, which I think it feels to me like they've snapped out of a little bit. Tom Carroll, I don't know about how you feel. I mean, obviously you being a close observer of the Celtics as well. It felt like the team I watched in the 10 games heading into the All-Star break was the championship team. There was, and I don't know if they just flipped a switch per se. I know that's the buzz kind of phrase, but it feels like they're on the right track heading into the All-Star break and now at the All-Star break.
So I think what a lot of people forget from last season with the Celtics is they had an insane season last year.
An actual all-time season. Their net rating for the season was like 11.2.
Right.
All-time good.
Including the playoffs, they only lost something, was it 21 games in total?
They were 16-3 in the playoffs, 64-18 in the regular season.
21 losses.
Yeah.
With the regular season and postseason
and in the conference
combined.
Finals, NBA finals combined, they lost one game in those two series.
So, yes, they were amazing last year. And they bring most of those guys back. But to expect a team to continue that pace in the year after they won a championship, after having a summer where three guys from your core go over to France to participate in the Olympics, and one of your starters has surgery and has to take time to come back to start the season, and Al Horford's a year older, And Jaylen Brown's seemingly got more jacked, so he had to figure out his new shot here.
Also, the Abu Dhabi preseason, they had to start training camp
that
early.
That didn't help either. So all sorts of stuff in the mix, combined with the fact that they set this incredible standard for themselves with how they played basketball last year, I understand why they're not going to be having a season like they had last year. It's okay. They're still really good, and they're still having a good season right now. And if they didn't have the year they had last year, which was historically great, you would not be having the belly aching that you're having right now around this team. And look, I'll admit, I personally have to continue to remind myself that I'm holding them to like this impossible standard. And they had this sort of post-championship malaise that they needed to kind of work through. And I guarantee you they're still going to have some annoying stretches in this second half, because that's how NBA seasons work. Teams aren't wire-to-wire amazing the way the Celtics were last year. That was an anomaly. It truly was. So I think that we all need to just keep that context in mind when we look at this team moving forward.
That's like the 2008 Celtics, wire-to-wire, 66-16. Then 2 years later, they went to the finals, but the second half of the season, they were a 500 team because they were resting guys, whatever. And I think the biggest part of this to me, and the biggest reason why I think they've been really good over the past 3 weeks, is their true starting five is finally playing together again. You mentioned Porzingis' injury. He didn't come back till November 25th. And on January 1st, their true starting five of Jrue Holiday, Derek White, Tatum, Brown, and Porzingis only had 85 total minutes together on January 1st. Now, they're at 277. So in the last 6 weeks, they played 192 minutes together. So I think that's been the biggest reason. These guys are actually playing together more. And even heading into the All-Star break, I know they didn't have Holiday and Brown for those last couple games. They didn't have Holiday for three of them. But on the whole, these guys have been playing together more and more. And I think that's been the biggest difference. So let's go to the phones here. 617-779-7937 is the phone line. And the text line, we're talking Celtics. Let's go to Matt in Rhode Island. Wants to talk Celtics. Matt, how are you? What do you got for us?
Hey, what's up, Lions? Carol, what's up, lads? It's good to hear you. And Carol, that's a great story that you have. Go get that Chick-fil-A money. That sounds like a commercial, buddy.
I appreciate it, man.
So, yeah, man. Cleveland, 44 wins in the first half. I think that kind of made the slight imperfections in the Celtics' first half a little more glaring. But here's what I have to say. You're talking about Tatum, Brown, Porzingis, White, and Holiday. When you get into the playoff series, that's an NBA all-defensive team right there. If they dedicate themselves to defense, they're just going to choke anyone out. I mean, Oklahoma City plays great team defense as well, but if we're really talking about it, like, no one's beating them in a seven-game series if their defense is on. Never mind their offense. Thank you.
Yeah, Matt, thanks for the call. I would agree. And on the Cleveland, look, I know Cleveland, obviously, at the trade deadline, got a little bit of an overhaul, but they've played Cleveland three times this year. And Cleveland's a great team. I'm not saying they're not. But the Celtics have won two of those games, and the game they lost, Jaylen Brown and Derek White both didn't play. So it's like, yes, Cleveland is a great team, but I still don't look at them in a seven-game series and say I think they're going to beat the
Celtics.
And
that's the key. And I know I'm about to sound like a homer. So,
but as Andy Hart says, and he's right, it's not a homer take if you're right.
Okay, so here's the question. And it's almost rhetorical because I don't think that there's an answer to it. Is there a team that you feel can beat this team in the Eastern Conference in a seven-game series?
No, I think Cleveland would be six games, and it would be tough and hard-fought. I think Indiana would be hard-fought. The Knicks aren't a real threat to them, I don't think. The Bucks.
See, that's
are
the
iffy.
Only team that I'm worried about is the Knicks.
I think Celtics fully loaded go in and win that series in five games.
I agree. No, I think the Celtics would win in six, personally. I just think that Brunson is the type of guy that steps up
and steals
a game or two.
Yeah, not to sound arrogant, put the cart before the horse, but like the only team I look at and I'm like, that's a real big dog for the Celtics is OKC. And the reason I say that is SGA is just as good as Tatum, right? That supporting cast is great. And 2 years in a row, January 2024 and January 2025, the Celtics have gone into OKC fully healthy, and they've lost both games. So that's, you look at NBA Finals series, and OKC very well could have home court advantage. The Celtics are going to have to win their home games and steal one at OKC. You know what I mean? It's not going to be like Dallas, where you go down there for game three, you get a 20-point lead, they come back, but then Brown hits a big shot, boom, you're up 3-0. It's going to be like, you're going to, that series, six or seven games, and at least five of the games would be close.
Yeah, and that's why I was specific in saying
the
Eastern
East
Conference.
Yeah, right.
Because OKC is a wagon, and I know they don't have the postseason success yet, but as a front office, they were just so smart in how they upgraded that team this offseason. They saw the two inefficiencies they needed, and they went out and they got it. They got Hartenstein, and they got Caruso. And they have all this young talent that has continued to be molded together and played really well. And SGA is a bona fide superstar. I mean,
yeah,
that guy
is a top five player in the league.
Incredible.
Yeah. I mean, the Celtics in January, when it scored 27 points in the second half, like that's and that's, so that's why, again, I'm not trying to put the cart before
the horse.
I am worried
about Chet Holmgren's health, by the way. Yeah. So like, if he's not healthy, I think the Celtics could beat OKC in like five personally. Yeah. But again, if they're fully loaded, I'm terrified of that team.
Yeah, and I still think the Celtics are better than them. I still think the Celtics would beat them, but that would be the toughest series this group has ever had.
I think the Celtics have a better starting five than OKC, but I think as a whole, like Boston, they're deeper than pretty much any other contender.
Oh, yeah, and I think, like, you look in the East, like, I think Orlando could give the Celtics a tough series, and that
they've,
if they're healthy, and they're so big, like, Banchero's huge,
yep.
Wagner, like, but I'm still like, the Celtics are going to win that in six games. Like, you know what I mean? So, like, yeah, it's a tough series. So I look at the Celtics' priority this second half, to me, make sure you're still a top two seed in the East.
Health.
And stay
healthy. That's
it. Yeah.
I want more minutes. Health.
I do want more minutes with that starting five together. I mentioned they're at the 277-minute mark right now. I want them to keep getting minutes together, because I think you're going to have to enter the playoffs in at least a little bit of a rhythm. Because your first-round matchup, if you're the two seed, like right now Orlando's the seven. That's not Miami last year. That's going to be a little bit like, I want you to enter in. And if you're the two seed and the Knicks are the three, again, I'm not a believer in the Knicks, but at least they're like good. So that's a second-round series. I just think I want more minutes together. But yeah, health is – and we said that in August. I mean, we were like, the key to the Celtics season this year is health. And we're now in February – and the key to the Celtics season this year,
well, especially,
is largely health.
With how the Eastern Conference has shaken out so far. I mean, Philly is an absolute dumpster
fire. Yeah, I was so wrong about them. I thought they would be. And I looked at it and I was like, okay, Embiid's an MVP caliber player. Maxey's an all-NBA caliber player. Paul George still has another year or two in the tank. They can be a threat to the Celtics. And man, they've been terrible. Like,
they're awful.
Just awful.
I mean, it's got to be one of the worst year one of, quote, like, dream team type teams to come together and just be
Milwaukee
atrocious.
Too. Like, Milwaukee makes the trade. They move on from Chris Middleton. But that's a team, the first month of the year, they're one of the worst teams in the NBA.
Yeah, and they've seemed to have figured it out more, a little bit more recently. But generally speaking, I mean, they had to move Middleton. Middleton just is not, like, a functional starting player in the NBA anymore. So they're really putting a lot on that two-man game with Giannis and Dame. And, I don't think that that's a team that can beat the Celtics in seven games.
Yeah, so overall, 39-16, second in the East, plus 9-point differential, top five in O-rate, D-rate, net rate. Are you satisfied with where they're at the All-Star break?
Yes, without question.
Yeah, I was hoping after the first week of the season they were going to win 70 games. Like that opening night against the Knicks.
They came out of the gate hot.
Yeah, and then it's just, again, injuries have piled up. They haven't had as much time together. So I'm a little disappointed that they're not going to win 70 games. But at the same time, I'd rather them win 60 or 59 and win a championship than win 70 and be out of gas in the NBA final. I mean, let's not forget, 73-win Warriors lost the NBA finals.
And we know Mazzulla is not afraid of playing his guys. And, you know, the out of gas thing is a real possibility for a team where a head coach is going to play his guys deep into games, even when they're, I mean, that's a thing he does still. So, yeah, I'm with you, man. It's more about health than it is the record. Just get one of those top two seeds, really even top three seeds. But let's be real, the East is what it is right now. They will be a top two seed in the conference, and They just got to figure out a way to get through Cleveland, and then who knows in the finals.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of where, and where, like, if you told me in July we'll be sitting at the All-Star break and say we think the Celtics are the best team in the league and they're going to repeat as champs, that's kind of what we're saying. I mean, really, I know they're a little bit off last year's pace, but as you said, last year was a historically great...
Well, it got dicey in December, but generally speaking, it has figured itself out here throughout January. I mean, the thing that kind of throws a wrench in that and why people were still like, oh, what's wrong with this team? Because when they would lose, they would be like embarrassing losses, right? So with that said, they still kind of righted the ship from a win-loss perspective in recent weeks. So I'm really not worried about the team.
We got more to get to here on this edition of Lions and Carroll. But before we do that, it is time to trend with the one and only Tom Carroll himself. That was Drake May talking about working with Mike Vrabel. I'm John Lyons alongside Tom Carroll. Got Tom Crisafulli producing for us. Tom, that's actually a very similar answer he gave Andy Hart and I at the end of the season on the afternoon program. He came on as a guest, and I asked him, what do you want to work on? What do you want to continue to develop? He said taking care of the ball and continuing to be, you know, smart with his decisions. And it's good to see that that's still a focus of his. And I know that's going to be a focus of Coach Vrabel and Coach McDaniels. I know that's going to be a focus of those guys because, again, as much as we liked Drake May this year, and I loved it, I had a lot of fun, did turn the ball over a lot.
No denying that. And it's good that he's, as the season went along, and now still recognizing that, because I want to say late November, early December or so, I was sitting in that press conference room every day, and he was asked multiple times in some sort of fashion, do you think you have a turnover problem? And the first few times he got asked it, he didn't handle it great. He would say like, no, not really. And then he'd kind of brush it off, and then he would pivot towards, you know, I got to take better care of the ball, blah, blah, blah. We all need to, blah, blah, blah. But it does feel like he is now starting to recognize, yeah, I did probably make a few dumb decisions.
When you turn the ball over 7 games in a row, I think that guy, yeah.
Yeah, so when you're double-digit turnovers and you only played 12 games, that's going to be something you need to address. And I know that he didn't have receiver help. He had guys giving up on routes, and he had bad offensive line play around him, but that only accounts for probably half of the turnovers.
And he only
right?
really played about 10 and a half games, because that Jets game, he got injured early, and that final game of the year, Joe Milton played almost the whole time.
Right, he played one
so
series.
Technically, so he did start 12 games, but he really only played like 10 and a half.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's good to see and hear that May is giving that real thought heading into year two. And heading into year two, he's got a new head coach, right? So he has new guys around him, and they're probably already in his ear about, these are our expectations for you, and this is what you need to work on, and this is the type of thing that we're going to try and implement. These are the things we're going to change, and this is the type of talent we want to put around you. That all has started in earnest down in Foxborough. And I want to ask you, John, heading into 2025, given what the roster looks like right now, let's say they are unable to bring in T. Higgins or Staley on the offensive line or bolster that defensive line. Like, let's say that they stick and pick at all their picks and they're kind of just running it back with some middling free agent talent, right? And I don't want that to be the case. They have $123 million to spend, right? But as it's constituted now, let's say that's what happens. And you have Mike Vrabel. That's like the big, if that's what happens, then Mike Vrabel being the head coach of this team is now, that's the alluring thing for next season, instead of like bringing in all this new talent. What's the ceiling for this team as we sit here today, and with that being the hypothetical that we live in?
So right now, just with, they walked on the field to start their season tomorrow, just as is, I think there's 6 or 7 wins. I'd probably lean 7. And I just look at, they're going to play a softer schedule this year. All the one possession games they lost the last 2 years. I think with Mike Vrabel as coach and Drake May in his second year, you're going to be a little bit better in those games. And let's be clear, 7 wins is still a bad football team. But I think Mike Vrabel, and I would add Josh McDaniels, Terrell Williams, some of the more experienced position coaches that they have. Of course, they lost Brian Belichick and Mike Pellegrino in the secondary, which I do think hurts. But you add in those guys in a second year of Drake May, I think you're going to win two or three more games. So I put it at seven. And Vrabel's a guy that, you know, one thing I was always impressed with is Tennessee teams, very efficient in the passing game. Because we think of Derrick Henry, right? He got the best seasons of Ryan Tannehill's career. I mean, and just from a perspective of like playing cleanly, in 2018, Marcus Mariota was their quarterback. He had 13 turnover-worthy plays per PFF. So it's kind of a lot. The next year, Tannehill in 2019, when they went to the AFC Championship game, had seven, and he was third in quarterback rating. And I think you can agree, Drake May's a lot more talented than Ryan Tannehill.
Yeah.
So I think they're going to get better football out of Drake May. So right now, I look at it, and I'm like, they can win six or seven games. If you put a gun to my head, I'll say seven. Still a bad football team, but I think you can see it's much better than last year. And just some of the – think of all the stupid mistakes they made last year, for lack of a better term. Like the miscommunication against Seattle, DK Metcalf scores a 56-yard touchdown. Their game plan in week three against the Jets and how bad they were tackling in that game. Like, you look at cover zero against the Rams, you give up a 69-yard touchdown.
Right? They like were in that game.
Right. So, but I'm saying, like, all these – like, I started to make a list of – questionable coaching moments earlier this year. I got like a page and a half long by the time they even got to the Chargers game. And well, obviously we saw what happened in the Chargers game. So I think a lot of those, Buffalo game, what, three turnovers in the second half, including May threw an interception at the end zone. Then there was the backwards pass fiasco as well. The Colts game, interception in the end zone. Like, I think a lot of those stupid mistakes, stupid pre-snap penalties, I'm not saying Mike Vrabel's going to walk in and those are going to be absolved, but there are going to be a lot fewer of those, I think, this year.
And the thing that we probably don't even realize is how many bad mistakes were being made behind the scenes. And we only just got a glimpse into that a few times. Perfect example of it that was put on full display by Gerard Mayo. Pre-game, he's on their network radio show, and he says, "I'm starting Antonio Gibson at running back." And then 90 minutes later, Ramondre Stevenson is on the field. And he never really gave us a clear answer why that change happened. Me personally, I don't think it's that big a deal who's running out there for the first series when you have running backs that basically get equal carries throughout the season. It's more of sending the message of, hey, I'm sitting you down because you've had some fumbling problems, so we're going to go with this guy. But the real thing that that speaks to for me is just a lack of control and disorganization overall. And that's just one example that we were able to tangibly see and hear, where behind the scenes, that probably was happening all the time in ways that we don't even know and will never know until someone comes out with one of these, you know, tell-all books about the season that was with Gerard Mayo. Because yeah. I think that happened way more than we really realized.
And I think, look at, like, the Jaguars in London. You had a 10-0 lead in that game. You blow it. But remember the 17 straight runs? And then in overtime against Tennessee, they ran the ball right down your throat down the field. And then Indianapolis to win the game was an 18-play drive.
18 or 19
plus
plays.
Plus the 2-point conversion. So those things... See, I don't see that happening a lot with Mike Vrabel. Now, I'm not sitting here telling you they're going to win all those games, but I think if, you know, once Jacksonville runs it seven straight times, I think Vrabel says, okay, they're not going to run. We're going to sell out, and they're not going to run it on us the next play or the next couple plays. Or Indianapolis, the 18-play drive. I don't know if that happens. You know, maybe that happens once during the year against a Vrabel team, maybe even twice, but three times? That's not going to happen three times against a Mike Vrabel team. So I just look at it. I just don't see a lot of those stupid, little, silly pre-snap mistakes or execution mistakes happening under Mike Vrabel. But I think that alone probably win you a couple more games or so.
Yeah, and we know his coaching staff is bringing in years and years and years of more experience than what Mayo's had. And that was one of the big issues heading into Gerard Mayo's first and only season as head coach, is everyone around him was really inexperienced, and a bunch of guys
rookie
that
head coach,
had kind of had
OC,
the job
DC,
but never did, or hey, I was an OC but I wasn't the play caller, and I'm a position coach that was coaching high school, more recently than we all probably realized. I mean, that's not what you want to surround a rookie head coach with. So now you bring in a guy that was coach of the year in 2021 with Tennessee. I think they fielded, what was it, 96 different players in one season, and they were able to be the number one seed in the AFC. So this is a guy that has shown that he can handle chaos and, you know, right the ship and get to the postseason when things are not in an ideal situation. And he has surrounded himself with all sorts of experience across the board on both sides of the ball. So I'm with you. I think that if they make no other changes and they'd stick and pick at all their spots in the draft, I think that that's good for two or three more wins just from the jump. And then you look at their schedule, and I know I did this earlier in the show, but I'll do it for this audience. Their home games next year: Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Atlanta, Carolina, Vegas, Giants, Bills, Dolphins, Jets. Road games: Baltimore, Cincy, Tennessee, Tampa, New Orleans, and then the three divisional games. A lot of winnable games on that schedule. A lot.
And I think another piece of the Vrabel, and I'll add in the McDaniels thing as well, they were terrible with player development last year. I mean, Drake May got better, Joe Milton got better, Marte Mapu got better, and that was three guys out of 53. It felt like the other fifth, like nobody else got better as the season went on besides
And multiple players got worse.
The receivers got worse. Felt like the offensive line got worse.
Yeah.
The defensive line got worse, especially against the run.
Absolutely.
I mean, it wasn't good against the run early, but it felt like it got worse and worse.
Yeah, and that
the
defense,
secondary got worse.
That defense
outside of Gonzalez.
Dealt with injuries. I'll give them that. But they, when they were back in quote healthy, it never looked like they were able to.
And the way
recover.
They came out of the bye week in Arizona.
I mean, that was embarrassing.
That's when I thought Mayo was in trouble.
Yep.
But my point is, player development was a huge problem last year. Because even Christian Gonzalez, I know he's an all-pro, great player, but I think he just was that good. He just got hurt the year before. I don't think he was necessarily a better player in 24 than he was 23. He just stayed healthy. I think he just is that good. And I think Mapu got better, May got better, Milton got better. But like you said,
Milton got better. He did. He got better just in time, didn't he? God.
The receivers got worse. Offensive line got worse.
I'm still salty about week 18, if you can't tell.
The Jawan Bentley got injured, but like Tavai was worse this year.
Tavai was
as a
way
player.
Worse.
The group
year.
As a whole was worse. So like that was the issue, is that if you're going to draft, you can have top five picks. Patriots have another one this year. If those guys don't improve and get better and develop, it doesn't do you a lot of good. Like your top pick in the first round, Drake May, got better. Your top pick in the second round, Jalen Polk, got worse. Caden Wallace had injury issues. Like your other picks didn't get better. So this year, if you draft a guy at four, I'm a lot more confident that guy's going to get better as the season goes on than I am about any of the guys from last year. And we talked about this earlier. I had Chad Graff on a show with Fitzy and I a few weeks ago, night show. He said the Patriots front office feels like they had a good draft last year and those guys were poorly coached and didn't develop. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. We'll see. If that is true, though, then those guys can get better under this new staff, whereas it just didn't happen under last year's staff.
I mean, clearly ownership felt that way. They brought Elliott Wolf back for a reason, right? And they keep touting this idea that he has this new draft grading system and they can fully implement it this year, yada, yada. Okay. I think he's probably more so there because he's the eyes and ears for Kraft in a new coaching regime where they know they're going to have less influence because Vrabel is not the type of guy that's going to allow the owner to come in and say, why don't you try this? What's going on here? Like Vrabel is going to command that building and it's Vrabel's way or the highway. So keeping Wolf in the mix there is their way to at least have some eyes and ears on the personnel front, especially with Cowden being there as Vrabel's kind of right-hand man in personnel. So yeah, I'm with you. The big thing with this organization moving forward, and this is not rocket science to say, but amidst all the losing, it has been lost that they've hit on their last two first-round picks in a massive
in
way.
In a big way. Two all-pro potential guys.
All-pro corner in Christian Gonzalez and a Pro Bowl alternate as a rookie in Drake May. And call the Pro Bowl what you want, but it just speaks to the fact that he is a top half of the league quarterback with all of the bad football going on around him. That's two consecutive first round picks that you've hit. If you hit this year and then you're picking in the, I don't know, teens, low teens next year, and you hit on that, now you're really cooking with gas as far as building a young core and moving towards something here. And that's what Philly did. That's how Philly was able to build towards what they are. They hit on their draft picks. So New England needs to continue to do that, and they need to be really smart about how they spend all of this cap space they have, which, if you haven't been paying attention, leads the NFL, $123 million in cap space to spend.
And I think, too, like 2021, they spent $250 million in free agency, and Matt Judon was a great signing. Hunter Henry was a great signing. Beyond that, not so much, right? Like, they need to take the money they have this offseason, and if they use it wisely, like if it's a T. Higgins and one or two other pieces that are good, then all of a sudden you go into next year, and maybe you and I are talking about 8 or 9 wins instead of 6 or 7. Like, and not to get ahead of ourselves, because this is a bad roster. The biggest reason that Bill Belichick still isn't here is that the roster was bad. Same thing, and as I think Gerard Mayo was a bad head coach last year. If the roster was better, he'd still be here. So I think that's still the biggest thing. So I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. It's still a bad roster. But I think there's clear avenues here with better coaching to improve this thing, I think, quicker than people are kind of anticipating right now.
And look, I'm not saying that because the Commanders were in the NFC Championship game that the Patriots are going to be in the AFC Championship game in 2025. Like, I know people continue to want to point at Washington and say, look, they did that turnaround so fast, yada, yada. Things worked out for them, and that's great. It's just tough to expect everyone to do that. With that said, it does show you that you can have that quick type of turnaround in the NFL where parity is something that the league prides itself on. And I know in recent years that has gone away a bit. You have a lot of teams making the postseason year after year.
But you still have the Texans breaking through.
Exactly.
You still have the Commanders.
You still have those examples.
You still have one or two of those at least every year breaking through.
So if they're smart about how they handle free agency, I think without question they can blow way past their win total, which I don't have in front of me, but I'm sure is somewhere around 4.5 or 5.5, right? So I talked about the schedule earlier this segment. A lot of winnable games there, man. So take advantage of this, New England. Go out and sign talent, surround your young quarterback with dudes that are proven, and go out and have a good draft and really get someone that can contribute from day one at pick number 4, and you'll have this thing turned around.
It's already been 4 hours.
Wow.
Tom, I know. It's been a great show. We're going to be right back to wrap it all up next here on WEEI. Back here on WEEI, a couple of scrubs, John Lyons and Tom Carroll.
How dare you?
With Tom Crisafulli. The three amigos of scrubs, I guess. I'm just going to let this play. Because this
Another
is Tom Crisafulli's. Yeah, he's back there singing.
Bye, then.
So, final segment of the show here. Thanks for all that have listened to us. Again, John Lyons alongside Tom Carroll. It's been a pleasure. Tom, our first time doing a show together. We've met before. We've done some Six Rings episodes down at Patriots training camp. It was a pleasure working with you.
Absolutely, man. And like we said in the break, it's so much easier to do a show when there's things to talk about. Yeah. So thank you, NHL, for putting together Four Nations. And thank you, Red Sox, for signing Alex Bregman. And thank you, football, for existing. Yeah. Because we're always going to have things to talk about when football is involved. But yeah, this is usually a very slow time of year when the NHL and NBA is on a break. So it's been really fun. This show has flown by.
Certainly has. And got a couple little odds and ends we want to tie up. Tom, 50th anniversary of SNL tonight.
Yeah.
I'm not really an SNL guy. I love their presidential debate or presidential like election shows. I think those are hysterical. Not really into SNL as a whole. I mean, you in on that? Like, remember, the NBA All-Star game thing, whatever you want to call it, is tonight. I know, you watching SNL instead?
So I'm DVRing SNL. I'm grabbing some dinner with some buddies after the show here up in Boston, and then I will watch the 50th anniversary of SNL probably at some point this week because we got Four Nations tomorrow. So, yeah, I'm super pumped about it. Here's the thing. I don't watch SNL with regularity anymore. I still will catch some monologues. I like Weekend Update. But the show just isn't funny anymore. Yeah.
When they had Norm MacDonald on that show, they were rolling.
Legendary.
But doing that.
It was awesome during my high school years. That was still kind of the heyday of when every 5 years it was just an awesome cast, and then that cast would be together for a stretch. And that was, you know, Andy Samberg and Bill Hader and Will Forte and Kristen Wiig and Jason Sudeikis and Maya Rudolph.
Hader's the guy from Barry, right?
Yeah, yeah. So
what a freaking show.
Oh,
by the way,
that
started
awesome
out as
show.
A comedy and then became dead serious. And I was like, oh, my.
Incredible television show. So, yeah, I mean, so I grew up with awesome SNL. And then before that era of shows, there was 30 years of awesome casts, you know. Comedy is written through SNL. The history of comedy goes through that show. So to see what it has become in recent years is kind of disappointing. I think they take some swings sometimes that just don't work. I think that they are so focused on bringing in celebrities to be kind of like the cameo guy, like bringing in Larry David to be Bernie Sanders. It makes sense, right? Like Larry
that
David
was funny.
Looks like him.
That, yeah.
And it's funny, right? But it hurts the rest of the cast because none of these guys get an opportunity to, you know, cultivate characters and kind of have their big moments. And then it just never is able to resonate. So I'm excited for the 50th anniversary show because I think they're going to do a lot of funny stuff and tap into some of the great history of the show, and I'm kind of a dork about all that stuff. But as far as like week to week SNL now, not really into it. Like when Shane Gillis did his monologue, I made sure and watched that. When Sydney Sweeney was on the show, I tuned in for that.
Why?
Big fan of her as an actress.
Okay.
So
big Euphoria fan.
Yeah,
Tom Carroll.
Right.
Yeah.
I loved that rom-com she did with Glenn Powell.
What was the name of it?
I don't remember.
Anyone But You.
There you go.
Tom Crisafulli.
So
saving Tom Carroll.
So yeah, I'm excited for it, but it doesn't mean that I'm gonna like relock into SNL every single week. It's kind of just like a one-off. And then whenever they do like a 55th anniversary, I'll get excited about that again.
Yeah, like I said, I love the presidential one. Like the dude that played Joe Biden this year, I thought was hilarious. Like that was great. Alec Baldwin as Trump was good earlier, and then they had a different guy play him last time around. So like I find those fun. Like when Steve Bridges used to be on it and he played like George W. Bush, like I thought he was perfect.
Yeah, I loved that. Will Ferrell as W.
Yeah, that was another
Ferrell
good
was
yeah
great.
So like those I always like enjoy, but yeah, SNL as a whole, I'm just and it's the same thing with like the late night shows, like Jimmy Fallon, great guy and all that, but like when it was Letterman and Leno, I would like tune in like at least once a week or so, and I was younger so I couldn't stay up every night, but
yeah,
I would at least try to tune in once a week because they would be great. In the last, like, 7-8 years, no interest in any of those shows.
Yeah, and I think just media in general has changed so much. Like, I used to love staying up for the late-night shows, and I would DVR them and catch them the next day. Like, I loved Conan back in the day. I remember during the writer's strike when I was in high school, Conan and his show came back early, and they were just doing ridiculous stuff. He grew this, like, what he called a strike beard, and he was just, like, spinning his ring on his desk. I mean, it was a blast, but as years have gone on, they just aren't as important anymore because there's podcasts and just media in general has changed. So the late night shows, they've kind of fallen by the wayside.
Well, that does it for our show today. Big thank you to Jacob Lastner and Tom Crisafulli for doing a great job producing for us today. Tom, as I said, it was a pleasure working with you today. Hopefully we'll get some more coming up in the future.
Absolutely,
and then,
man.
You're on Fox Sports Radio tonight. I'll be back with Fitzy and Dan Ball tomorrow at 2 p.m. until 6 p.m. Until then, enjoy your night. Make sure you tune in to the Greg Hill Show tomorrow morning at 6 a.m.